What about those the Jewish kids in this country that were just like the Muslims, and they were allowed to get off? They were protesting somebody. Am I the only one that heard about that?
I don't think I know what you're talking about.
Okay.
What's the question?
Does somebody?
Can you talk about that?
Ali, yeah. Do you know?
Yeah. I think you're referring to the Irvine 11 and why were they prosecuted and not others. It's not a question of Jewish kids or nobody else would have been prosecuted like these young people were prosecuted in Orange County. And it's impossible to imagine that any students would have been prosecuted for doing exactly the same thing to, say, President Ahmadinejad of Iran. You remember he spoke at Columbia University a few years ago. Or if students had had done the same acts of disruption, but their message had been one of support for Israel, would Orange County have prosecuted them? So really, it's not a question of saying, you know, Jewish kids, I did this in Chicago. I stood up and I disrupted Ehud Olmert, and many of us did. We weren't prosecuted. We didn't know if we would be arrested or not. We were ready to, but, you know, they wouldn't have prosecuted us in Chicago for this. So that's what's so outrageous about this, because I think it is intending to send a message, at least across California, and if not across the country, that protest is being criminalized. And that's, you know, something that's a danger to all of us.
This is for Alice Walker. Alice, my parents left their shore to come to this country in the early 1900s. Today, Palestinian students are not allowed to leave their shores to go to a university in London or New York. What do you think about that?
Well, I mean,
do you have any idea of what we can do to help them get away from, to get to the school that they want to get to?
Yes, you can help them. You can find out what you need to do to help them and then help them. To me, that's actually very simple. It may not be as simple to you, but I think in every case where you see a need and you can find in yourself a place that responds, go there and work from that place. I was just thinking about how to really make some of the changes that we need to make. And actually, I hope I will get around to writing this poem. But for instance, changing the world is really a lot simpler than we sometimes think. Like if you hire someone who has many, many fewer dollars than you, I won't say a poor person, because sometimes poor people are actually quite wealthy in many ways, but if someone comes to you and they have very few dollars, or no dollars, maybe nothing, then part of your duty is to actually, and they are coming to you for work, part of your duty, I believe, to them and to changing the world is to actually pay them more than they ask you. I also feel that when the same person with no dollars and no pennies comes to you and they have children, that your duty is to ask about the education of their children and to help them fund that education. These are things that have never been done systematically at all, and hardly ever, of course, under enslavement of people and extermination of people. But imagine what it would have been like if the people who basically worked our parents to death had said to them instead, you know what, I'm going to make sure that you are paid more than you think you're worth, because often people with few dollars think they don't have much worth, and I'm going to see to it that your children get as good an education as they possibly can, even given this horrible situation of what segregation or Jim Crow or whatever it might be. So my feeling is that there is a place of personal responsibility in the world, and that looking always to other larger forces can be very debilitating. It can make you feel weaker than you are. Whereas if you just start with the need that you see that appears, needs appear in your kitchen, they appear in your on your doorstep. You know, every day there's something that comes to you that you can do. And just do it.
I have a question for Ali about what's maybe going on at the UN, because I know you've written a lot about a one-state solution, and what's going on at the UN is about two states. And I have friends that ask for my opinion, as little as it is, and I need help in communicating some support for the Palestinian need to be recognized. At the same time, a demand for two states that I don't feel is viable. So I'd really like your insight and advice and help with this.
Thank you. Let me see if I can. I think a lot of people felt a sort of emotional satisfaction at seeing Palestine placed at the center of the UN agenda, at the frustration of the United States and Israel in trying to block this initiative, in seeing a standing ovation for the speech that Mahmoud Abbas gave, in which he enumerated for the first time, we're not used to hearing him speak about what actually happens to Palestinians. And I can understand that people felt a lot of satisfaction about that. I think there's a kind of satisfaction in seeing UNESCO voting by a large margin to approve a preliminary, at least a preliminary step for Palestine to join UNESCO. And Hillary Clinton, who I forget whether she is now the Israeli foreign minister or the US Secretary of State, railing against this and saying how, you know, it's such a terrible thing if the Palestinians join the United Nations Educational, Social, and Cultural Organization. It really shows a deep hatred for Palestinians, a real vicious hatred that you wouldn't want them to join an educational, social, and cultural organization. A little bit like trying to suppress children's art shows really a virulent hatred for Palestinian children, I think. But I think that the challenge for us is to remain focused beyond these largely symbolic steps on what they do for Palestinian rights. And I think that we must not confuse statehood for rights. Statehood and rights are not the same thing. In fact, there are too many states that have violated their people's rights and do violate their people's rights. And we see also in so much of the, what's sometimes called the third world, there was a great optimism and hope after formal decolonization in the 1950s and 60s that turned to disappointment, because having a state did not change the fundamental colonial relationship between North and South and between the former colonial powers and the former colonized countries. The colonial relationships simply were expressed in different ways. And I think that, you know, a Palestinian state, if it were born tomorrow in whatever shape, would already be, it would be born a failed state. It would be the shortest, instead of going from independence in the 1960s to being a failed state in the 2000s, it would be simultaneously independent and failed at the same time. And it would be failed not just because Israel would retain control over the land, the people, the water, the airspace, but because it would already be organized and ruled like so many other states by a very rich, limited neoliberal elite who are already running the Palestinian Authority in the interests of very few wealthy families and excluding the vast majority of Palestinians from having any say. And I speak for myself, but I want something different. I don't want that. It doesn't interest me. And so I think the debate among Palestinians has been to try to bring this back to what it does for Palestinian rights. And in leaving behind what doesn't work and going to and leaving the shore to something else, one of the challenges is to bring the voices of Palestinians back into this, because the so-called peace process over the past two decades has been about systematically disenfranchising Palestinians, of redefining the Palestinian people to eliminate the diaspora and the refugees, to eliminate Palestinians in Israel, and to reduce the Palestinian people to the West Bank and Gaza Strip, and then eventually to reduce it to the West Bank and to hell with Gaza. Gaza is now excluded as well, and maybe tomorrow the Palestinian people will just be Ramallah, and maybe then just a few neighborhoods of Ramallah, and then maybe a few households in Ramallah, and they will be the ones who speak for and represent the Palestinian people. And that's why I resist the UN initiative, because it also ignores the fact that Palestinian civil society hasn't called broadly for, yes, there was some enthusiasm, a kind of euphoria. A lot of it was sort of orchestrated, but some of it was genuine. It's simply for the reasons I mentioned. But beyond that, Palestinian civil society didn't call for this UN initiative. It did call for BDS. And the BDS call sets out demands that are more than just statehood. They're about the rights of all the Palestinians, those in the West Bank and Gaza, those in what is now called Israel, and the diaspora. And so that's the measure by which I think we need to look at any initiative. Does it include all Palestinians? Does it advance all their rights? And the statehood initiative at the UN, despite the emotional satisfaction of some parts of it, just doesn't do that.
I have a question for Ali, right over here. I'm from Santa Cruz, and I saw what I've been keeping an eye on what's going on at UCSC. Tammy Ross Benjamin, the professor that brought the complaint forward and is getting the university investigated for being, you know, quote, anti-Semitic. And it disgusts me that all this government money and energy and all this is going in, and everything you said about them using something that's supposed to be dealing with civil rights for such just backward cause. But anyway, I'm now attending UC Berkeley, and I've seen some ads in the paper at the campus at UC Santa Cruz, and also similar propaganda going on at UC Berkeley on campus, where groups like Stand With Us are presenting this really simplified version, which isn't surprising because it's easy for people to swallow and most people don't really understand the issue. But what they're presenting is basically that Obama is saying there needs to be negotiations, Netanyahu is saying, we're saying yes to negotiations and yes to peace and yes to this, and then they have Mahmoud Abbas saying no to a Jewish state and no to negotiations and no to, and it's like a completely simplistic, ridiculous thing. But I'm just wondering if you could say, like, if you were to encounter that kind of propaganda on campus and you were a student, like, what would you say to those people who are saying that Mahmoud Abbas is no to a Jewish state, no to negotiations?
Yeah, it's very simple. I use a simple analogy. I probably used it here before, the pizza analogy. And you know, at the AFSC event the other day, the director of Chicago, AFSC in Chicago said, you know, your pizza analogy, have you ever tried it in real life? I'm going to say what it is now. I said, no. He said, well, I tried it in real life recently with a group of young people in a classroom. But basically, you know, if you imagine two people or two groups of people negotiating over a pizza, and while they're negotiating, you know, if I'm one of the parties, I start eating the pizza as fast as I can. What more do you need to say? So even if you accept the notion of negotiations and accept the notion of two states, it's patently absurd when, you know, one side is eating the pizza as fast as possible. And that's it, it's simple. And they don't have an answer to that. So, but really, you know, I think we've moved beyond that kind of simple propaganda. And they know it, which is why they're not relying on it. They're relying on these kinds of intimidation tactics that I spoke about earlier. And the reason I chose to focus this evening so much on what's happening in this country is because I really do think this is where the battle is going to be won and lost. And this is why the resources are being put into fighting us back here. And the steadfastness of Palestinians on the ground, of Palestinians in Gaza, the importance of the work that Mecca is doing, is all crucial. But the battle is really going to be won and lost to a large extent here. And it's not just, you know, Palestine is in many ways the keystone, but it's about much more than Palestine, because it's about, you know, what kind of country this is going to be. One of the, I mean, I think a lot of the young people involved in the protests have the right idea, but I saw one sign on the internet I didn't like. I think it was in a protest in Indiana, where there's, you know, people, there's lots of stereotypes about Indiana, but there's lots of working people who are suffering there as everywhere else. But it talked about the United States as a once proud nation. And I didn't like that because, you know, this is a country with a terrible history. You can only be very proud if you exclude all that history. But really about the future, this is a country where, you know, Amanda Knox has helicopters following her back home. You know, they do like the slow, the O.J. Simpson car chase with helicopters for Amanda Knox. And nobody's talking about the continued occupation of Afghanistan, of Iraq, of the expanding U.S. wars in Yemen, in Somalia, you know, the spread of AFRICOM and U.S. militarism into Africa, just a country that executes people, whether by drone in foreign countries or by poisoning them while they're strapped to a gurney in this country. I think when the president talks about shared values with Israel, you know, we really have to think about what that means. So I went broader than your initial question, but I, you know, the battles on the campuses are really part of a much bigger political struggle that I think we have to see ourselves engaged in.
I'd like to ask you about some of the battles in regards to BDS, because I'm with the Ecumenical Peace Institute, and we're aware of the battles within the churches. The Presbyterians and the Methodists, I know, are both struggling with trying to get BDS adopted by national bodies and so forth, even by local and statewide bodies. And that's why our dinner is going to be focusing on that subject, by the way. But anyway, can you speak about the battles for BDS in the various and sundry battlegrounds?
Yes, and I just want to take this opportunity to say that there's a petition going around, and Jane, who is wearing the fantastic flag dress, if you are a California resident, be sure to sign the petition for the California Divestment Initiative to get Palestinian California state pension funds out of companies that support Israeli human rights abuses. The battle about BDS is, you know, it's so interesting. Good question. Boycott, divestment, and sanctions. Boycott, divestment, and sanctions. And a good way to find out more is to go to the website bdsmovement.net. And it's got all the basics, and I think that's important to know. But BDS isn't just about victories and defeats. It's not just about, did you win this campaign or did you not win? It's about educating people along the way. And that's a very crucial part of BDS, that it's still a long road. And there have been more victories in terms of getting investments withdrawn or contracts canceled in Europe. South Africa, the University of Johannesburg took a historic decision to break ties with Ben Gurion University in Israel because of its close support for Israeli government policies and occupation militarism. So there are victories around, there are so many in Europe that it's really, we're at a stage where it's still gaining momentum in the United States. We're still on a much a shallower path. But as I said, I think that the power of the movement is recognized by our opponents, which is why they're investing so much in trying to stop it. But I don't think throwing millions of dollars and slick ad campaigns is going to stop it, because the people in the churches, the people in the unions, the people in the universities and elsewhere who are taking these initiatives forward, in my experience, having met them all over the country, have a dedication and a determination and a calling that only gets strengthened by that kind of opposition. So I have a lot of faith and belief in those people that they're gonna that this movement is really gonna take off in this country.
Hi there, thank you for coming. I actually learned quite a bit tonight. I'm not too familiar with all these issues, but I'm glad to be here, and I appreciate your excellent speeches. Excuse me. I actually marched today with the Occupy SF group and immediately came here afterwards from an invite. As you all know, there are thousands of people who are pretty fed up with this capitalist system that was mentioned. I'm curious, are you familiar with some of the post-capitalist, global, cooperative sustainability movements that are going on now, and I wonder if they would, if you weren't, if you'd like to. I could speak on them, I guess, for a moment, but there's so much to say. I'm a member of what's called the Zeitgeist movement. If, I don't know if any of you are familiar, but it's basically moving beyond capitalism and competition into a total global equality well-being society. So my question is, have you heard of it? And if so, could you speak on things like that? Curious.
Well, I think that all the thinking that we can be doing now, all of us, is good. And sometimes we don't know what the other person is thinking. But that should not prevent us from coming up with our own dream of how we want this world to be. So I think, for instance, that not only is capitalism a fatal disease of people, because you have to just keep buying and selling and cutting trees and destroying rivers in order to make a profit, but that there are so many other ways that people sitting in circles together can come up with. And I say that we should do that. For instance, I have no interest at all in the electoral politics of this country. I just feel that it's a failure. And every 4 years we get suckered into believing that we can actually change through a corrupt system that has never worked for us. And I think the time has come for us to just let it go and to sit with each other and talk about what would we like. You know, do we really want to be led by one person? I don't. I mean, I can barely lead myself as one person, but I certainly don't want to look around and think that a president, whether it's a man or a woman, can actually lead us. I mean, look at what has happened to Obama. He has been sucked into a machine that has been destroying us all these many hundreds of years by now for some of us, you know. So there is a different way, and there doesn't have to be just one way. I believe very firmly in the council model, which when the quote white founding fathers got here, they actually learned from the Indians that you actually can lead people and lead yourself in council, and you have to be also in council with the women. When the white people came to talk, quote, peace and whatever, while they were stealing land from the Indians said to them, where are your women? That's the crucial question. Where are your women? So whether a structure is, you know, some model that looks great, that people are putting forward, I mean, that's fabulous. But the question has to be for all of us, how are we going to make this thing egalitarian? And how are we going to make the each gender feel that it is our right to lead in this perilous time? Because if we can't have a system, we can't have a system that really listens to all of us, and where the women are not turned into men, we're doomed. For instance, when we were on the boat, getting to go on the boat, who should side with Israel against us but Hillary? Now, I know a lot of you in here voted for Hillary, didn't you? Yeah, well, anyway. So she said that basically we were a threat, you know, to Israel, and that Israel had a right to defend itself against us. Okay. If this is what we're going to have by electing women who rapidly become male-oriented, we don't want that. And we don't want a system in which that can happen. So it's on us. It's such a wonderful time. I mean, maybe, you know, they say that, you know, to make a tree, a barren tree, produce fruit, you threaten it with fire. And maybe we are being threatened with fire. Maybe that's what this is. We are being threatened by fire, and we are to produce some fruit. Are we not going to make it? And it's us. It's not them. It's not that. It's not who. It's not when. It's not where. It's all of us. And if it's not all of us, it will fail.
If I may add one thing, because there's one topic we didn't address tonight, which is we talked about what's happening here, and we talked about Palestine and the connections, but Palestine also exists in the broader Arab context, and what's happening there is incredible, because the uprisings in Arab countries have inspired people here. All of the official dogma is that they're supposed to learn from us. We're the leaders. We know democracy. And yet young people in the streets here are being inspired by the uprisings in the Arab world. And what connects them, and maybe some of us realize it and some of us don't, is that it's a struggle really against the same forces, because the counter-revolutionary forces in the Arab world are the same forces that people are starting to rise up against here. We're beginning to see the crumbling of the system that's existed since the end of World War II, of U.S. hegemony in the region, of U.S. imperial power replacing European imperial powers in the Middle East, or in West Asia. And we see the United States fighting tooth and nail against Arab uprisings. And none of these revolutions are completed, not in Tunisia and not in Egypt especially, where you see the U.S. Through its relationship with the Israeli military, trying to maintain, if not Mubarak, then Mubarakism. And you see the U.S. fighting to keep a regimes in place in Bahrain and in other countries where all of a sudden it has no interest in people's rights. So it really is a global struggle, and the jury is out as to where it will go. But I think that as much as we can do to raise people's consciousness of the direct connections and the methods, you know, the methods that are being used, the more likely we are to succeed, I think.
So we're just going to take one more question, and when we're finished with the next question, if people will form, you know, two single lines so that you can come up and either get your book that you're buying in the lobby now or brought with you, have it signed, or just want to come up and meet Allie and Alice, that's fine too. So before that last question, I want to thank everybody for coming. And I want to remind you, please sign the MECCA mailing list so you'll know when these events are happening in the future. And what's the last question?
So this is the last question. It's I hope it's a good one, because it better be, because it's the last one, right? But a perfect segue to what Mr. Ali just talked about is sometimes I feel like the hardest question as a half Jordanian, Palestinian, with roots in the Hejaz, like the hardest question I face is, where are you from? And that is a very serious question, because I think right now with the so-called Arab Spring, the colonially constructed nationalisms are falling. And yet you see in the last attempt where Mahmoud Abbas was at the UN trying to plea for to construct a false nationalism for himself and his people. And I see there's this inverse relationship going on, and that makes me wonder as to why. I mean, why is it that there are some in the Palestinian leadership still like going after these false gods, and if that's because they're in the concentrated in power today, then where is the Palestinian people's Tahrir Square, and where are they meant to make these, where are these conversations meant to happen? Where are our streets? And more importantly, and the T-shirt flag is very charming, but at the same time, to me, it poses a very sad reality that we're still thinking in terms of nationalisms. Like, we still want flags, we still want to wave, we still call ourselves us Palestinian with this Palestinian culture and stuff. That's all good and great, but I mean, aren't we still playing the same old game of just independence and nationalism, and aren't we still going around in circle? Even with the Libyan revolution, they're carrying the kingdom flag right now, and to me, that's like, why did we go back? Why are we reversing? Why are we nostalgic for a greater past? Why can't this leaving the shore envision something bigger than these like restrictive nationalisms?
Wow, well, that was just beautiful. I mean, I think you posed all of the questions that I think are the urgent ones we have to face. I speak only for myself, but I know that I also meet a lot of young Palestinians and others when I travel. And I know that what you said resonates with a lot of people, that the flag and the state doesn't answer people's aspirations anymore. It doesn't meet their needs. And I think especially in a world where people are very connected, where, you know, people do see what's happening everywhere, and I think they do yearn for something that transcends these notions that we exist in little blocks, delineated by lines. You know, an invisible line has just such tremendous power over people, and you know, I I'll say something very briefly personal, which is that, you know, I had a very good life growing up. I had every advantage. I had the opportunity to have the best education, and I recognize that that was a gift I had that many people didn't have. But the one thing I never had really was a sense of belonging anywhere I lived. Everywhere I lived, I didn't feel like I really belonged there. And so I had to develop, I think, a sense of, you know, the question I always disliked the most is, where are you from? Because it's never a short answer. You know what I mean, right? It's a long discussion, and sometimes you don't feel like having that discussion. But where I'm from is my community, and my community is defined very broadly. And mostly, my community is defined by people who are struggling for the same things I believe in wherever they are. And that's the community that I aspire to belong to and aspire to be considered part of.
You know, I think another answer to that question might be that we don't know. And that I, you know, as somebody who has been in many movements my entire life, whether it was fighting the war against the war in Vietnam, whether it was writing laws and fighting for the rights of children with all abilities and disabilities and suing states and schools, up until today, I don't think that we have a real vision of where we really want to go in the world and in this country. And I think maybe, you know, the folks on the street and those that join them might be coming up with some answers for us. And that young people, you know, we haven't done such a great job. I'm 70 years old. And although I've tried to make differences and make a change, you know, we've belonged to different parties and we've struggled for many, many years, and we've struggled for flags and nationalism, and now we don't know where we're going. And I think in a way that's very freeing too, because we know what hasn't worked, and now hopefully we're open to a new way of thinking, and it's gonna be a journey for everyone. Thank you for coming.
Could I just say one thing? We belong to each other, and we belong to the planet. And in a way, we have to go through these baby steps of nationalism and being a people separate to understand that, to get to that place where you are me and I am you, and this mother that we're on is ours and we are hers. I think that is the vision that I believe most deeply in. Thank you.
So anybody that wants to form lines and come on up, please do it.